First time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting on the eve of his first address to the opening of the UN General Assembly. President Donald Trump Monday warned the U.S. could take additional measures to address Venezuela's longstanding economic and political crisis. He met with Latin American leaders on the sidelines of the UN meeting.
This corrupt regime destroyed a thriving nation by imposing a failed ideology that has produced poverty and despair everywhere it has been tried.
Mr. Trump said people are starving and the South American country is collapsing. He called the situation unacceptable and said democracy must be restored soon. Earlier, the president called for reform of the UN.
We seek a United Nations that regains the trust of the people around the world. In order to achieve this, the United Nations must hold every level of management accountable, protect whistleblowers, and focus on results rather than on process. To honor the people of our nations, we must ensure that no one and no member state shoulders a disproportionate share of the burden.
The U.S. currently provides nearly a quarter of the U.N. budget, nearly one-third of the funds for peacekeeping operations. Mr. Trump, at a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the U.N. Monday, said he believes there is a chance to make peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
We are giving it an absolute go. I think there's a good chance that it could happen. Most people would say there's no chance whatsoever. I actually think with the capability of Bibi and, frankly, the other side, I really think we have a chance.
Mr. Netanyahu said they would discuss Iran's growing aggression in the region. Israel and the U.S., meanwhile, inaugurated the first American military base on Israeli soil that includes a missile defense system. This is VOA News. Iraq's top court Monday temporarily suspended next week's planned referendum on independence in the semi-autonomous northern Kurdistan region. It's a vote strongly opposed by the central government in Baghdad and several nations, including the U.S. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal advised the Iraqi Kurds to go carefully.
The Kurds will have to think twice before they actually go ahead with it. But the way things stand, they've gone this far out, it's unlikely that they'll be willing to walk away from it.
The vote is scheduled September 25th, involving three provinces of Iraq. Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani said a yes vote would not lead to immediate independence, but kickstart serious discussions with Baghdad. Syrian troops have crossed the eastern side of the Euphrates River in Deir ez-Zor, drawing closer to U.S.-backed Syrian rebels battling Islamic State fighters. A commander with the Syrian Democratic Forces said the rebels are prepared to turn government forces back. The SDF said it came under Russian and Syrian attacks Saturday. Myanmar State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi was to address her nation Tuesday on the security crackdown in western Rakhine State that sparked a mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims to Bangladesh. She's been under growing international pressure to end the violence and allow hundreds of thousands of refugees back to their homes. Tong Tun, Myanmar's national security advisor, attended a meeting on the violence at the UN Monday.
We want to make sure that everybody who needs humanitarian assistance gets it. So this is without discrimination. We will make sure that everybody who left the home can return to the home, but this is a process that we have to discuss.
The military of Myanmar, also known as Burma, launched its crackdown following a series of attacks by insurgents last month. The French technology company Otimorfo, that supplied electronic systems used in Kenya's now nullified August election, said the biometric voter identification software needed for the October 17 rerun will not be ready by then. It's the date the Election Commission set following a Supreme Court ruling that overturned the results of the August 8 election won by incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta over widespread irregularities. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis announced Monday the U.S. is sending another 3,000 troops to Afghanistan, an increase of over 25% in the number of American forces there now. The new deployment will raise the number of U.S. forces in the country to over 14,000. A man was killed, several people wounded Monday in a suicide attack near a security force vehicle along the Pakistan-Afghan border. A breakaway faction of the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility. The European Union Chamber of Commerce called Tuesday on China to move faster to open up its state-dominated economy to foreign business, warning of a possible backlash over inaction. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September the 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The United States government is ending temporary protected status for citizens of Sudan as of 2018, but it is also extending it for citizens of South Sudan. And in South Africa, the Supreme Court in Bloemfontein plans to hear the state's appeal of former athlete Oscar Pistorius, currently serving 6 years behind bars for murdering his girlfriend. The state will make the case that 6 years is a lenient sentence for the crime of murder. And Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, has launched a financial campaign to help pay for the cost of the medical treatment of parliamentarian Tundu Lissu, an avowed critic of the government who survived an assassination attempt.
Different people are contributing through their telephones in Tanzania. Some people are contributing via GoFund platform on the internet. And yes, many people are contributing from different parts of the world.
Freeman Mbowe is the chairman of the Tanzanian's main opposition, Chadema. And the World Health Organization reports some progress is being made in reducing premature death from non-communicable diseases. But it says much more needs to be done to save the lives of nearly 40 million people who die every year from preventable causes.
If we don't take action now to protect people from NCDs, we will condemn today's and tomorrow's youth to lives of ill health and reduced economic opportunities.
Douglas Betcher is the WHO Director for the Prevention of Non-Communicable Diseases. Stay tuned for those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The United States government is ending temporary protected status for citizens of Sudan as of 2018, but it's also extending it for citizens of South Sudan through mid-2019. Temporary protected status allows nationals of certain countries, mostly countries that are facing armed conflict or major natural disasters and are currently in the United States, to temporarily remain and work here. Both Sudan and South Sudan's designations were due to expire on November 2nd. Sudanese nationals are allowed to legally stay for another year, but then must leave or apply for other types of visas allowing them to stay in the country. And in Uganda, the police arrested 10 youth for staging a rally to oppose a planned constitutional amendment to allow President Yoweri Museveni to run for another term. Uganda police spokesman Emirian Kayima said that the youth were detained in the capital Kampala as they mobilized support and distributed flyers with messages opposed to the amendment. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, has launched a financial campaign to help pay for the cost of the medical treatment of parliamentarian Tundu Lissu. Mr. Lissu, who is the chairman of the Tanganyika Law Society and an avowed critic of the government, is currently undergoing medical treatment in neighboring Kenya after surviving an apparent assassination attempt. The parliamentarian was airlifted to a hospital in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, hours after he was hit with 5 out of 32 bullets sprayed on his vehicle by an unknown assailant. Police say they have launched an investigation but have yet to make any arrest. Officials of the opposition party say so far supporters of the group in the diaspora have contributed over $16,000 to help defray the cost of Tundu Lissu's treatment. The party officials say the group has established accounts on social media platforms as part of the effort to raise more funds for the treatment of the lawmaker. Freeman Mbowe is the chairman of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema. He tells VOA's Peter Cloti that colleague parliamentarians are also contributing financially to help pay for the cost of Tundu Lissu's medical treatment.
We have launched several fundraising platforms to try and mobilize resources to help Lissu get the best of the treatment that is possible. And different people are contributing through their telephones in Tanzania. Some people are contributing via GoFund platform on the internet. And yes, many people are contributing from different parts of the world.
How much money are you seeking to raise to help with this medical treatment?
We really have no target at this point in time because we don't know how long the treatment will take. But surely it's going to be a long-term treatment. The doctor said it may take up to 6 months of treatment, of intensive treatment, either in Nairobi or anywhere else. So we are mobilizing as much resources as we can really raise. As you know, Nairobi Hospital is one of the most expensive hospitals. It's one of the best also around the region in East Africa, but it's also one of the most expensive hospitals. So consequently, the medical bill is quite high. And this is being attended by a number of consultants, you know, and surgeons. So you can imagine all those people need to be paid. And so the general cost of initial treatment will end up being quite high. So we need to mobilize as much money as we can. Our members are mobilizing. Our members of parliament are also contributing and mobilizing more resources. Our friends living in diaspora are also contributing. Even you guys can help us also in this contribution exercise.
What is the current state of affairs of Tundu Lissu at the moment as he receives treatment in Nairobi, Kenya? And I understand that Chadema plans to also possibly transfer him to the U.S. to seek further medical treatment. What can you tell me about this?
Tundu Lissu is still critically ill, to be honest. He was seriously injured. He's still critically ill, but stable. And transferring Tundu Lissu from a facility in Nairobi to any other facility, whether in the U.S., in Europe, or elsewhere, will definitely require an air ambulance because he cannot sit, he cannot stand, he has to be airlifted, and he's on so many, you know, supporting machines. So definitely he needs an air ambulance, he needs to be moved. But we are waiting first for our doctors to say whether there's any really serious complications that will require moving or evacuating him from Nairobi. At this point in time, we are concentrating on stabilizing him. And then at a later stage, maybe the doctors may advise of any further action to be taken. But at this point in time, we're just focusing on stabilizing him, making sure that he has moved out of danger completely before we think of an evacuation.
I also understand some Chadema members were arrested over the weekend for organizing prayers for Tundu Lissu because the police say that they are not supposed to do that. What is the latest development on that?
For sure, the police have been arresting some Chadema members who are wearing Tundu Lissu's T-shirts, and we find it very unfortunate. And we are actually going to lodge official complaint to the police because people are sympathizing to what happened to Tundu Lissu. As a human being, you really have to feel that somebody was actually pumping more than 20 bullets. This thing has caused a discomfort to many people in Tanzania and even abroad. Being Chadema members or not, that doesn't really matter. But people have been sympathizing with what happened to Tundu Lissu. People are condemning whoever organized the raid on Tundu Lissu and the barbaric way in which was actually carried out. So people are complaining. Some people are praying for his life. Some people are praying for other leaders' safety. And it's unheard of for police to stop people from praying to God. It's a weird exercise when you see a police officer arresting people who wants to pray. They should actually be giving them enough safety and protection to ensure that they pray peacefully. And once they finish their prayers, they can all disperse. But, you know, refusing them to assemble for prayers, we find it being so barbaric, and really it's very unfortunate that is happening in Tanzania today.
Freeman Mbowe is the chairman of Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. According to human rights groups, rape and sexual assault are widespread in Somalia, even though few victims ever come forward and few perpetrators are ever punished. Change, however, is underway in the Puntland region, which has opened the country's first forensic lab to investigate sexual assault. From Garowe, Somalia, reporter Neha Wodeka has the story.
Local officials cut the ribbon this month on Somalia's first forensic laboratory dedicated to testing DNA from sexual assault cases. The lab, located in the town of Garoway, opens less than a year after the Puntland region enacted its first law criminalizing sexual offenses. Since the law went into effect in December, 63 sexual assault cases have been prosecuted, resulting in 35 convictions. The penalties have included jail time, fines, and public lashings. Puntland's Minister of Justice and Religious Affairs, Salah Habib Haji Hamma, says the lab will aid enforcement.
We used to send DNA from here to Nairobi or from here to South Africa. So those restraints now are easy. We can manage this and answer, get answers within timely period, within hours, within minutes, where we used to have days, sometimes months, to get to receive those.
Puntland's Minister of Women, Marian Ahmed Ali, is also hopeful.
There will not be a stigma. There will not be a discussion about who did this, who did the crime, who did the rape, who did, So it's a big encouragement.
Many women do not report rape in Somalia, and the cases that are reported often wind up being settled by community elders, says Keith Shamis Kabdi Bile of the Criminal Investigations Division in Puntland. Bile stands out in her bright orange sneakers and blue hijab. She is the only woman police officer in her unit. She says, there are some police officers who say rape is not a big deal and consider it a minor thing. They say that it is nothing new. The police department as a whole remains under-resourced. Bile said she hasn't been paid in a year and has to conduct her investigations on foot as she doesn't have a car. During our interview, a teenage girl came to Bile complaining because the male officer assigned to her rape case wanted her to settle it in her community. VOA watched as Bile called the male officer in for a scolding and took control of the case. Bile says, a woman cannot tell her problem to a policeman, but a woman can tell her problem to another woman. I like to help when a woman is being abused and do whatever I can to capture those who are harassing her. At the nearby local hospital, armed police stood guard outside the small women's center. It is a safe space for survivors of sexual violence that advocates are using to get the word out about the new forensic lab. One survivor agreed to be interviewed on the condition that VOA change her name to Fatima. She and her friend were collecting firewood near an IDP camp in Puntland a year ago when Fatima says three men attacked them. Fatima says she was 4 months pregnant. She said she began to bleed the next night and lost the baby days later. Fatima, like many women in Somalia, never reported her assault. She says, I was shy and said to myself, don't tell your story to anyone because it is shameful. I even hid the story from my husband. The hope is that with the new law, the new lab, and community outreach, more women in Puntland, like Fatima, will see justice. Neha Wadekar for VOA News, Garoway, Somalia.
The World Health Organization reports some progress is being made in reducing premature death from non-communicable diseases, but it says much more needs to be done to save the lives of nearly 40 million people who die every year from preventable causes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
In this latest global assessment, the World Health Organization reports cardiovascular and chronic respiratory diseases, cancers, and diabetes continue to be the world's biggest killers. Every year, it says 15 million adults in the most productive period of their lives, between the age of 30 and 70, will die prematurely. The biggest risk factors are tobacco, the harmful use of alcohol, unhealthy diets, and lack of physical activity. WHO Director for the Prevention of Non-Communicable Diseases, Douglas Betcher, says the world is not on track to meet the Sustainable Development Goal of cutting premature NCD deaths by one-third by 2030.
The window of opportunity to save lives is closing. This is playing out before our eyes in many ways, including increasing numbers of people, particularly children and adolescents suffering from obesity, overweight, and diabetes. If we don't take action now to protect people from NCDs, we will condemn today's and tomorrow's youth to lives of ill health and reduced economic opportunities.
Despite common perceptions, Boettcher tells VOA, premature deaths from non-communicable diseases are not just a rich country problem.
80% of the deaths are in countries that are already often stressed. Their health systems are stressed with the usual conventional burdens of disease, communicable diseases, maternal child health problems, and then this is an added extremely large burden for the health system.
WHO reports Costa Rica and Iran lead the 10 best-performing countries in reducing deaths from non-communicable diseases. It says six countries have achieved no progress at all. Five are in Africa: Angola, Equatorial Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Sao Tome-Principe, and South Sudan. The sixth country is Micronesia in the Western Pacific. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in Southern Africa, hopes that the tiny nation of Lesotho might find political stability have been shattered by recent events, including the shooting death of the country's army chief and the arrest of a journalist who was critical of the government. Southern African heads of states met over the weekend to discuss a way forward. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
An election in June was Lesotho's third poll in 5 years, after two coalitions collapsed amid infighting and meddling from the army. The third time was supposed to be the charm, as new Prime Minister Tom Tebane promised to loosen the military's stranglehold on politics. But the killing of the army chief by two subordinates 2 weeks ago has raised concerns that more instability is ahead, and the arrest of a journalist and the shutdown of his radio station have made the situation even more dire, critics of the government say. In the last 3 months, says opposition politician Frohang Sekamane, the nation has fallen under the reign of terror.
The police can seize anybody, doesn't matter how very high placed they were. A person at the level of minister can be taken, instructed to come to the police, and they do that, and then they can be tortured for 3 days, and then also over the weekend and forced to say certain things. That is what I mean by terror.
In a written statement sent to VOA, the opposition documents a litany of events, including the arrest, alleged torture, and subsequent flight of an opposition lawmaker. The nation's communication minister confirmed the lawmaker's August arrest, but said he was called in as a person of interest in a murder case and was treated well while in custody. Rights watchdog Amnesty International says it is also worried about recent events in Lesotho. Researcher Shireen Mukadam.
Really, what we're seeing is patterns of arbitrary arrests. We are seeing allegations of torture and other ill treatment. We're seeing a lack of progress into criminal investigations for unlawful killings. And we're also seeing attacks on freedom of expression in Lesotho.
The opposition and rights groups are calling on the international community and on the Southern African Development Community to assist in restoring the rule of law. Southern African Development Community, or SADC, has made numerous attempts at mediation. Heads of state met over the weekend in South Africa to discuss the issue, with host President Jacob Zuma saying, "We cannot and shall not be in Lesotho forever." Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. And still in South Africa, the Supreme Court in Bloemfontein has set down one day in early November to hear the state's appeal of the disgraced former athlete Oscar Pistorius, who was sentenced to 6 years behind bars for murdering his girlfriend, River Steenkamp. However, the state argues that the former athlete's 6-year sentence is inappropriate for the crime of murder. For more on this story, Nadia Sami reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Disgraced athlete Oscar Pistorius may soon find himself back in court. The National Prosecuting Authority's application for leave to appeal his 6-year prison term for murder will be heard on November 3rd. The state has called this term shockingly lenient, and prosecutors will argue for a minimum 15 years, which is mandatory for murder. The Paralympian, who at one stage of his career had the sporting world eating out of the palm of his hand, is now serving time for killing his girlfriend, model Reeva Steenkamp, on February 14, 2013. Now, Pistorius has always maintained that he believed there was an intruder in his bathroom before firing several shots into a closed toilet door, not knowing, according to him, that it was Steenkamp on the other side. He went on trial and was initially found guilty of culpable homicide and slapped with a 5-year prison term. But the state successfully appealed that and had the charge changed to murder. He then got a 6-year term instead from the same judge, Tokozile Masipa. This will be the second time the state appeals the Valentine's Day murder. This high-profile trial had South Africans glued to their screens. The entire trial, over about a month, was broadcast live and it offered eye-opening insight into the way the South African justice system works. There was massive public interest given the fame of the man in the dock and the vulnerability of the victim's elderly parents who listened to what was no doubt for them painful testimony in court. This time around, Pistorius is trying to fight off and fend off this possible appeal, and we'll all head to the court on November 3rd to see how events play out. This is Nadia Sami for VOA Africa, Johannesburg.
Faced with the lack of African architects on the continent, company Masdane Group helped establish the African Design Center in Kigali, Rwanda. The firm is headed by architect Christian Benimana, and it recently wrapped up its first year and is still in the middle of training its first crop of fellows. Benimana talks to Ricky Shryok about African architecture and the hopes he sees on the horizon.
I think one of the things that we are realizing is it is a great idea and everybody recognizes there is a need for it and everybody approves that we do it and approves the way we're doing it and everybody is willing to help us or support us to make it happen. I think the only thing that I've discovered is that when it comes to the financial side, it is still being compared to many other existing models, which are not necessarily similar.
Is there a shortage of African architects on the continent and designers? And if yes, why do you think that is?
So the simple answer is yes. The long answer is it's complicated. I honestly don't know why that is. I think every country has its own situation. For instance, there are countries that never even started the program of architects. Since they got their independence 50 years ago. Some of them started the programs, but through the series of events and political unrest and budget cuts, they saw a very big problem. And some countries weren't even as far as closing them completely. For the past 50 years or half a century, that has really had a really big impact on setting up the profession in the continent. Many countries still don't have the legal framework for architecture and civic professions to operate in. I can't say for certain there's not enough architects on the continent of Africa, but I can say for certainty there's very few practicing architects, African architects on the continent.
That was Christian Venimana, director of African Design Center. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Kigali, Rwanda. And that's it for this Tuesday, September the 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. Thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow morning for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the 72nd United Nations General Assembly opens with a theme focusing on people, striving for peace and a decent life for all on a sustainable planet. Host Shaka Sali and his guest will discuss the UNGA's theme and its importance for the people of Africa. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.